All right, my next guest on the show is an American stand-up comedian, motivational speaker, and a former U.S. Army soldier, a husband, a father, and a Purple Heart recipient, Bobby Henlein. Appreciate you coming on the show, man. I know we tried to schedule it several times, and I had some stuff get in the way of it, but I appreciate you're here now, and I can't thank you enough, man. Your story is amazing, and I can't wait to share it to all the viewers.
No, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I know life happens. It's hard to schedule stuff these days.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially with what's going on in the world today, man. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But I want to kind of get into your background, you know, where you grew up, what made you join the military, and the route you took in the military. And you joined at a pretty young age at 17. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, joined at 17. Wasn't thinking about it. I grew up a Navy brat, and I didn't think military was the way I was going to go. You know, I was the roller skating DJ at the rink. You know, I was cool. I had a mullet. But I was heading the wrong path. I was heading the wrong way and starting to get into trouble. And my uncle actually talked me into joining the military. He said, you know what? We should go in together. He's only 6 years older than me. He's more like a bigger brother than an uncle. So he said, let's go in together. And I said, all right, you're right. We need to do this. He didn't pass the ASVAB. I did. And so that's what got me in the Army at 17.
Wow.
Which I needed it. My mom hated signing for me to go in at that age, but she knew that I needed it. And she was not very good at giving out discipline. So I had to go somewhere else to get my discipline and grow up.
Absolutely. The military is the way to go. Now, that's kind of crazy because a lot of guys going in on a buddy system, but the other buddy doesn't make the system to go in with you. That happened to me. So that's kind of cool. That kind of happened. And did they know you were 17? Were you allowed to go in at 17?
Allowed to go in at 17. Your parents have to sign for you. But you can't be deployed until you're 18.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. So you go through basic. Where'd you go to basic at?
First time I go to basic, Fort Leonard Wood. I went in as a 88 Mike, a truck driver. Said you can basically drive a broken truck or fix a broken truck. I said, well, I guess that a tow truck driver? That sounds a lot easier. I'll do that one.
Absolutely. My buddy's an 88 Mike.
Fort Leonard Wood, I did my basic and AIT there. And back in 1989.
Wow. I was 9 years old. So, once you, turn 18, I guess you end up getting deployed to, Desert Storm, correct?
Right. Yeah. I turned 18 just after I got out of my AIT, you know, my truck driving school. So as soon as I got out of that, I turned 18 right after that when I got stationed at Fort Hood. But then Desert Storm kicked off. I just turned 19. In September, and then October 10th, I shipped out to Desert Storm.
Man, that's young to be going over, you know what I mean? I bet you had a world of emotions going through your mind, thinking, man, I just...
Yeah, it's weird when you go in, you're not thinking you're going to war. You have no idea what's going on in the world, really, at that age either, right? You're not really paying attention. But then it hits you, like, we're going to war. But then again, you don't want to be left home either. You know, my mom tried going, oh, you're the only son, you know, tried saying that rule. You can't go. You only want to carry on a namesake. Well, they changed it at that time. If you didn't have a mother, brother, father, sister, direct family member that was wounded in war or killed in war, then that rule is gone anymore. They didn't have that anymore. They changed it to the last namesake thing. They got rid of that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I thought it was still going on.
No, they changed that, and which was good. It gave me excuse to, all right, sorry, mom, got to go. Because, you know, you go to basic training. Some of these guys I went to basic training with, all my training, got stationed with them. And now I know they're getting deployed. And I can't be, I'm going to stay home because I got to carry on my namesake. You know, they don't give a shit about my name. we need you out there. And you don't want to leave them behind. You want to go with the team, the guys you've grown up with in your training.
Yeah, pretty much needs of the Army by that point.
Yeah.
So, where was you at your first duty station? Did you stay at Fort Leonard Wood?
Yeah, no, I went to Fort Hood. Fort Hood. Texas for 3 years.
How was Fort Hood?
I was supposed to go to Korea. I actually came on orders to go to Korea, but then Desert Storm kicked off, so they canceled those orders, and so I went there instead.
I did a 2 year stint in Korea. I was at Camp Hovey. It was amazing, but that's a whole nother deal.
Yeah, it's probably a good thing. I probably got in trouble at that age the way I was going in. Which happens to a lot of us over there, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I had a good time, then that's all we're going to talk about, if you know what I mean. But so you come off that deployment, any, we don't talk about, you know, deflating people or anything, but did y'all get to see any combat there? Was it kind of behind the scenes?
I was mostly behind the scenes. I was, they ended up making me a fueler, doing a fuel truck at Hemet for artillery unit. So we did some raids and stuff in the beginning before we actually went over the burn, before the actual, you know, storm kicked in during SHIELD. We went over the burn a couple times, did some raids and stuff like that. Going, the guns would fire, I'd fill them up, we'd run back, did that a few times. Had some incoming that were totally off, totally missed. So that was about as close as it came during Desert Storm. Most of the time I, you know, learned how to play volleyball in MOP level 4.
That's always fun. So you come back from Desert Storm and you end up getting out. Was it because they were kind of forcing people out, or you just wanted to get out?
No, that was the time, though. It was a time where they were kind of cutting back on the military. But actually, they were giving me orders to Hawaii. They were trying to tease me with Hawaii. If you stay in, I just figured, hey, you know, I did my time. I did my combat tour even. You know, I'm done. I'm going to go back to school and get out.
Yeah.
That's why I got out.
So what did you end up doing when you get out? You just kind of work different jobs and...
Exactly. I bounced around doing you know, roofing, radio, truck driving. It's funny, when I first got out here, I was a truck driver, military, like driving in a war zone. But then I was still too young, so I got out at 20 years old. I did 3 years. I got my 20 years old, and nobody's going to insure a 20-year-old truck driver in the civilian world. So I couldn't get a job driving like auto parts around. It was
so it was kind of a struggle.
So was that?
It was kind of a struggle.
Yeah, it was a struggle with work-wise. I went back to school for a little bit, and I just couldn't deal with school. School's always been a struggle for me. And so, and then just going back to the younger generation, even though they're a few years younger than me, it was a different thing. The experience that I had in life at 20 years old, that they had experiences that were in college, were totally different. So I felt, you know, different from everybody else and left out. So I decided to drop school and just go to work. You know, I worked warehouses, radio, the railroad, UPS. I kind of did it all.
And that's a kind of a very good subject you just touched on, because a lot of dudes get out and they struggle, because they don't feel like they fit in anywhere, and then they come right back in. But then there's a lot of guys that don't come back in.
You don't even realize it. You're like, oh, you're just so excited to get that ETS date, and you're getting out. You're like, I'm going home. I'm going to be happy. Nothing could, you know, bring me down. I don't have to do any of this political stuff. As you know, the political side, going to combat and doing our jobs isn't so bad. It's the political stuff we got to deal with there in garrison when we're home that gets kind of irritating. You know, why do I have to wax this floor just because the general's coming by?
Yeah, you're seeing your weapon like crazy.
You're tired of that stuff, but you miss the camaraderie. And you don't realize how different the outside world is to the way we are, the way we're trained, and just our mindset.
Yeah, and you miss kind of cleaning that weapon all day, even though it sucks when you're doing it.
Right. It's like, I swear, I got all of it off. No, well, we got some extra ones, and these people are another detail, so you got to clean their weapon.
Absolutely. So 9/11 happens, and then was it like, would you think about going back in before 9/11, or 9/11 like kind of secure that thing for you?
That was the thing that kind of really secured it. I always kind of wanted to go back in, but I got married. Once I got out, I got married, and my wife at the time did not want to be married to anybody in the military. I didn't go, you know, in the police force because she didn't want any kind of uniform. She just didn't want to deal with it. That was kind of lifestyles. So I didn't do any of that, but I always wanted to go back in. I knew I missed it. And so then it was getting close to 9/11 about to happen. And, you know, I was talking to a recruiter, and he said, well, it might take, you know, a long time. You've been out for 10 years. The background checks, it takes forever. You know, then by then my name might not be taking prior service. And I said, well, you know, I'm thinking about it. So I was thinking about that and a couple of career jobs. And then 9/11 happened like the next month. And of course I called the recruiter, like, can I come in now? And how funny, they got me in like in 3 weeks.
And you went infantry then, right?
No, I tried. I tried to go. When I came back in, I said, hey, I want to go airborne, infantry, ranger. Like, I'm going to do it all this time. And they said, no. I'm like, what do you mean? No? How bad was my test score that I can't go infantry?
Yeah.
But then what they did is you had to come back into your same MOS.
Really?
Which didn't make any sense, because they still maybe go back to school and get trained on it again. I mean, it's a truck driver. It's not that difficult. But I still had to go back. I had to go back to basic, back to training. But the thing was, the Army needed truck drivers. So they're like, well, no, you got to come back. They got me. So they gave me choice of station. That's the only thing that kind of gave me the choice of station. They wouldn't even give me airborne.
Really?
No, they wouldn't even do that. But then at AIT, they came around and go, hey, who wants to go airborne? I'm like, try doing that. But I realized it's because the bonuses. The recruiter wasn't going to waste a bonus on me. He needed that lure for somebody else. I was coming in no matter what. He had me. I wanted back in. So he didn't need to lure me in with that. So that's how I ended up going airborne, is in AIT.
Oh, that's awesome. And then you get stationed at the 82nd, correct?
Correct. Yep. Which was 82nd that? Fort Bragg. And I originally signed up. They gave me choice of station. I picked Benning because I knew if I was at Benning, I could probably get a slot in school, in the jump school. But since I changed my contract during AIT, that wiped that out, and 82nd owned you.
Gotcha. How was the 82nd for you?
I had a great time. The camaraderie is great. You work 24/7, of course, especially being a driver. You know, if I wasn't jumping, I was picking somebody up from a jump. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, everything just kicked off in Afghanistan. So we're getting guys out. If you weren't deploying, you're helping somebody else to deploy. And so it was really, really busy during those times.
So how many deployments do you go on after September 11th?
After September 11th, I go to Iraq 3 times. So, yeah, 4 tours total.
Damn.
But I did, 2003, the first deployment to Iraq in OIF. And then that was a 12-month deployment. Came back for about 10 months. Went over to Fort Carson during that time. Then deployed for another 13 months with Fort Carson with 3rd ACR. And then that was in 2005. And then came back from that. And at that time, they started to dwell. The dwell time. So you had to be home as long as you were gone. You know, if you're deployed 6 months, it'd be home 6 months. Deployed a year, it'd be home a year. So I got back from Carson. You know, 3rd ACR was shutting down and moving back to Fort Hood, or was it, well, what's the one I'm trying to think of? El Paso, Fort Bliss.
Fort Bliss.
And I was like, yeah, I don't want to go there. So I ended up going back to 82nd. During that time, I had to go to BNOC and everything during the move. And so I got back to Bragg. That was in 06. My unit just deployed. So I still had 6 months dwell time. So they wouldn't send me out with them. So I had to sit out, you know, home for 6 months, and then I finally got the ship out in 07, March of 07.
So I was in Tikrit in 05, and that was a damn terrible time to be there. 05.
Oh, yeah, you weren't that far away. I was in Telfar.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So you were right down the damn road from me. 05, man, that was when the IEDs really started kicking off bad, real bad.
Yeah, especially up there in the north. I mean, they're all coming in from Syria and stuff, and that's where we're kind of watching the border up there with 30 ACR.
Yeah.
Telfar had all these schools going on and training that we had to go in and clear that whole thing out. It's kind of a whole Fallujah thing up there. Mm-hmm. We just had to put a berm around the whole city. So, all right, if you're good, come out. If you're bad, we're coming in to get you, type thing.
So you're on your fourth deployment, and that's when the attack happened.
Yeah, in 07, I get deployed. I was only gone 3.5 weeks. You know, by the time I got to Kuwait, got to my unit, I've only been with my unit maybe 2 weeks tops. And I saw when I first got there, I was supposed to go to a different unit with my unit, but I was supposed to go to Alpha Troop. But I saw they scratched that out because Delta Troop needed an E6 transportation guy. And they were getting hit left and right. They got attached to First Cav just north of Baghdad, you know, during the surge, trying to help out with that. So I got with them. I mean, the first day I'm out on the road with them, 8 daisy chain IEDs. You know, luckily they found them, route clearance found them. But it was just day after day. They were getting hit. We lost 22 guys that year from one unit, 22 guys in one tour. And again, I was only out there 1.5 to 2 weeks actually with the unit when my Humvee got hit on April 7th.
Like for the view, a lot of people don't understand, like when you're going out, you're rolling. And I know for me, I gunned on them. I drove, I gunned. Everything you see is like, is this going to blow up? Is this going to blow up?
Right. There's trash on the side burning, some other holes, pile of rubble. There's all kinds of stuff out there. The funny thing is, you know, what they tell us, if it doesn't look normal, be aware. But the problem is the thing that doesn't look normal to us here is normal there. Mm-hmm. A donkey tied up in the middle of the road in the intersection is not a big deal. There's a little spot there. They're burning trash by it. Not a big deal. That's normal. So it's hard to tell what is exactly not normal. You got to get used to that area first. Of course, that's what they did. Most of their attacks, were mostly done when we were doing right seat rides, right? We're changing over units. That's when they attack us the most because the new unit's confused.
Yep. Yeah, that's the tough part because you're trying to train a new unit of the area of operation, and it's just, man, it's a tough deal.
Yeah, the unit's trying to figure it out. You got guys getting complacent because they're getting ready to go home. So it's the best time, and they knew that, and that's when they would hit us most.
So are you doing like a patrol, and then did you run over an ID, or was it an EFP, or...?
Yeah, we run around doing supplies, going to all the FOBs to make sure they have the supplies, doing a supply run, checking on them, bringing soldiers in and out and different things like that, and equipment to build them up. So we were doing that. We left probably 7:30 that morning, maybe 8 o'clock out, and I got hit at around 1700, 5 o'clock. And so I don't remember the whole day. I remember having an extra cup of coffee that morning before we left. And the only reason I remember that is because of the captain that was sitting behind me in the Humvee is the only time he went out. Captain Grassball was the S4 captain. So when he came out, he was just checking his everything again, checking the supply line, making sure everything was good. So he came out, and that's the only reason I knew it was that day, because he was running late. And I thought, he's not here yet. We can't roll out. I'm going to get an extra cup of coffee, get my energy up. But
yeah,
it turned out to be for the scene report afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
We had just left one of the bases, one of the FOBs, and it was 3 to 4 artillery shells, 155 rounds that were buried in the center of the road.
Damn.
It threw the Humvee 20 meters, leaving a hole diameter of 5 feet, 3 feet deep. I mean, it took that up armor Humvee and just tossed it, and of course went sliding upside down.
Mm.
Destroyed it.
And you were in the TC seat,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was the TC. Yeah, we're the lead vehicle. I was the convoy commander.
And if I'm correct, you're probably one of the only ones that made it out, right?
Right. Yeah, there's 5 of us total in the vehicle. You had the driver, the gunner, and me. We picked up a soldier coming back in, and then we had the S4, the Captain Grassball in there with us too. So out of 5 of us, I was the only one that survived the IED attack.
Mm. And... yeah, I saw you. You made a video the other day. It kind of touched me a lot with the drinks. And yeah.
If I try to do something every year, you know, like I talk about all the time, you know, not a day goes by that I don't think about them and their families. But of course, when that anniversary date, that live date comes by, it brings out more emotions. Like your body knows it. You maybe get busy and not think about it, but your body knows it and you feel it every year.
Yeah. It was a touching little video you put on there, man. I was pretty moved by it, and it's pretty special. And I know it's special for you. And I do this podcast a lot because of guys dealing with PTSD, suicidal thoughts. And I know a lot of guys have survival guilt. And, you know, with your injuries, you know, that would be hard for the normal person to even – how do you go through that?
In the beginning, and it still hits you every now and then. You know, it's not very good. PTSD, survival guilt, it's never going to go away. It's something we learned to live with. So I have to remind myself this all the time, because the first couple of years were the hardest, especially with survivor's guilt, is to think about it. If you were the one that didn't make it home, what would you want for the ones that did make it home? Of course, you want them to continue their life. Live their life to the fullest. Don't waste the life that they've been given. And you know, that's how you should really show respect, is to live your life to the fullest. Don't waste it. Have some fun, have some drinks, live life, but don't abuse any of that stuff. Enjoy it, live to the fullest, try to help others. And that's how we respect those that we lost. And they want that for us.
Yeah. I mean, I've had buddies when we got back that made it through it, man, and just commit suicide. And I've never had them thoughts, to be honest with you, and I hope I never do. And, you know, there's a lot of people struggling with it, and that's why we have that 22 a day. And it's sad. It's a sad world we live in with that stuff. So is there any motivational?
Big thing for me in the beginning too, with the survivor's guilt, was the suicide thoughts. I just thought it'd be better. I thought my family would be better off. You know, I had young kids, they'd take care of me. I felt useless. I couldn't see probably for 18 months. Mm. You know, I had my kids had to help take care of me, tie my shoes, make sure I didn't trip on stuff. I had vision, but I had medicine in my eyes and these goggles I had to wear all the time. So it made it really, really hard to see, kind of like driving like in a storm, a rainstorm with no windshield wipers. So having my kids help me with that, and then my wife at the time had to do my wound care every day, and it took 18 months to get skin to take on top of my head. My head was burnt through the skull. So to get that, I mean, she could have given me infection any day. So I just felt like a burden to the family. I felt like it would be easier for them. They could move on. Every surgery I had, they're worried. Is he going to die in the surgery? Is he going to get an infection? Every day, wound care. Did they accidentally put a germ in there? So I just thought they would be better off, that I want to die to just make life easier for them. You know, boom, he's dead. We can move on from here. We just know the answer. But not having the answer and having that risk every day just made me feel bad for them.
Well, man, you're a stand-up guy in my eyes, because I don't know how I would deal with it. You know what I mean? I'm being 100% truthful with you. You know what I mean? I even see people in wheelchairs. I'm like, I don't know how I would live if I was in a wheelchair. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. We don't know until we're tested. Yeah. And, you know, people always say, well, I couldn't do what you do. I said, well, you never know. If you were to tell me before this happened, that this was going to happen. Like, you're going to be a sole survivor. You're going to go through 48 surgeries. Your skin's going to be missing off your head. You won't never be able to close your left eye again. You're going to lose your left hand. And if you tell me all this stuff is going to happen to me, but don't worry, you're going to be on stage laughing about it. You're going to go back overseas to Iraq, Afghanistan, and do stand-up comedy for the troops. You're crazy. There's no way I could ever do that. That's not possible. That's not humanly possible.
It's crazy how you turn that into a positive, you know what I mean? Where a lot of people, I don't think they could, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that having the right people in my life that kind of pushed me that direction, or, you know, I was crazy thing. I was an atheist. I didn't want to believe in religions because I didn't like a lot of stuff. Like, if you rape somebody, you kill somebody, you hurt a child, you get to go, oh, I'm sorry. Now you get to go to heaven. I didn't like those rules. That was just me. I was like, I don't like that. I wouldn't be part of that. So I didn't want to believe anything. But after I got injured, I was in a coma for 2 weeks, medically induced. But I remember from the coma, when I came out, being on like a giant iceberg. Mm-hmm. Is the best way to explain it. A giant white iceberg. It's nighttime with stars out. It's very clear. It's comfortable. It's not cold. And I heard voices coming out of the sky just telling me, you're going to be okay. Your family's waiting for you. Then when I woke up, like, okay, there's a higher power. I don't believe God does stuff to us. Like, oh my God, how could you believe in God? Because he let this happen to you. No. And I, as a human, had a choice. Another man had a choice. He made a bomb. Our choices led us to this. I think where God stepped in is God said, you have this ability. You don't know it, but I know what you can do. Now, still as a human, I still had the choice to make that decision. Was I going to do it or not? I could have sat on the couch and forget this, or drink my life away, going, I'm useless. And I felt like that's the way I was going to go at first. Mm-hmm. Now, I always use my sense of humor to get through stuff. I mean, everybody does. I mean, you got, especially in the military, law enforcement, medical, you know, in the hospital, you got to have a sixth sense of humor, a little bit of dark humor to deal with what you see every day. When people are dying in front of you, getting injured like that, you have to have a sense of humor to deal with it. Otherwise, you'll go crazier than you already are, right? For picking that job in the first place.
100%. So what led you to comedy? I know, but for the viewers that don't know, like.
Right. Yeah. Again, that route. At the hospital, joking around. The hospital staff thought it was funny. The other wounded veterans thought it was funny. And when I had my hand amputated, is when I kind of first started doing it at physical therapy a lot more. Mm-hmm. And my occupational therapist, they said, oh my God, you're so funny. You should do stand-up comedy. And I'm like, I don't know. It's funny here. There's no way I'm going to go to general public and go, guess what? I got blown up in Iraq. Isn't that funny? Like, the general public's not going to laugh at that.
But the way you say it, it's even nagging. Funny.
But veterans are laughing right away already. Hell yeah, that's funny. But I didn't think it'd work, but she kept bugging me to try it. So eventually I said, all right, I'm going to prove you wrong. And that was 13 years ago that I said, I'm going to prove you wrong. And I went and tried stand-up comedy. Now, again, that day, nobody laughed. I got 3 minutes on the stage at the Comedy Store in L.A. Nobody laughed. But really? It felt good for me just to talk about it, to get it out. And it's fun to make other people feel uncomfortable.
Do you think they didn't laugh because they were intrigued by you? You know what I mean? Like they were trying not to laugh because of your injury. You know what I mean? They didn't want you to.
What I found out at these open mics, when comedians are starting off or they're practicing new material, depending on what level they're at in their career, it's only other comedians. Sometimes some friends will come watch them, but pretty much in the room, it was just other comedians waiting for their time to go up.
Oh.
So even if it was funny, they were analyzing what you're saying. Mm-hmm. They were practicing their own material, getting ready to go on stage next. But one of them did give me a compliment after I got off stage. So I thought, okay, that's cool. And so I went back to San Antonio, and just for me, it was therapy. I started going to open mics all over San Antonio and just practicing the comedy. It was therapy for me to talk about it, joke about it. It was also another way to, who knows who's listening? The 5 people in the audience at open mic, 10 people, you know, it may help that one person. And if I can do that, then I'll just share my story through comedy too. And that's what I learned with the motivational speaking, is by sharing my story, I can help others. I didn't realize that at first, but just because the news media kept coming to see how the Wounded Veterans were doing. And then I did one thing with National Public Radio, and it was kind of when I turned that corner from feeling sorry for myself and wanting to die. You know, I prayed to God for like 18 months just to take me, that I'm useless, I shouldn't be here. I just didn't want to wake up the next morning. But I turned that corner. I finally got the skin graft to work on my head. I'm getting my independence back. I'm driving myself to my doctor appointments. And so once I turned that corner, I'm like, okay, I can do this. You know, if the reason I'm alive is just to raise my children, to be an example for them, then that's a great reason to be here. To live for the ones that didn't make it home, then that's what I got to do. I can't waste it. So I just started being positive at that point. And I found out through the one story on NPR that other people saw my story. They heard an interview like this and they said, oh my God, you know, I can't fathom going through something like that, being positive on the other end. So it helped put life in another perspective for them that they weren't thinking of. And I've learned that over the years, that by doing that, if everybody shared our story, I mean, this is my story, but we all got our stories. We all could help somebody else by sharing our stories. And so that's what I try to tell people, you know, this is me. Today I get to remind you, but tomorrow you're going to be reminding me. I need pick-me-ups too. I need reminders. You know, because I don't wake up every day going, hey, life is great. No, I'm moody. my hair might not go right. The beard might look weird one day. you know, I get frustrated because I can't fix something because I got one hand. Like, I just moved and I'm working, trying to fix up this new shop I got. And I'm having trouble with it because I got one hand. I'm trying to clean the floor, paint the walls, and do all this stuff. And it gets frustrating. But I look, okay, I got friends with no hands. I got friends with no limbs. I don't have a friend without a head yet, but I don't know. There might be one out there. But, you know, I got to put life in perspective for myself, too, when I go, life sucks, I got one hand, you know? We all need reminders.
Yeah, absolutely. You got me, man. No, man, I think you're amazing, you know, because... And like you said, you don't know until you're put to that test, and you have done an amazing things with it. You know what I mean? Do you have a website that people can go to? Do you?
Yeah, of course. I got the Well Done Comedian. You know, I started doing comedy and they're like, hey, you got to brand yourself. I'm like, I'm already branded. I got the Well Done Comedian.
Oh, so, boy.
Yeah, you can go to that website. The Well Done Comedian. You can reach me on there, Bravo748.com. Bravo748 is a speakers bureau that my fiance and I started, and that helps military and law enforcement with speaking engagements.
Oh, that's awesome, man. I just heard a plane go over. I thought it was in my... Do you hear it?
No.
God, that's so weird sounding.
But of course, all social media, you can find me there and reach out there too. It's,
you know, absolutely. Have you wrote a book?
I have not wrote a book. I'm not a big book reader either. And I think that's probably why. I do write a lot of, I write poetry, I write comedy, and I do some songwriting. Lyric wise, I, I cannot write the music. The rhythm thing is not there. I can dance, but I can't write that rhythm.
Yeah.
But, now,
where all do you go to do motivational speaking? Is it all over America, all over the world?
Yeah, so far I've done Mexico, Canada, and U.S. And it could be from a high school to a homicide detective meeting going on. I've worked with law enforcement, churches, all kinds of businesses, Boeing. You know, everyone needs a reminder story. And I got something a little different with the humor added to it. So I think a lot of people like that with hearing my story is the humor side of it. When I share my story, I'll definitely always leave with a nice little comedy set at the end. You know, you may cry here, but you're going to laugh here and you're going to see that anything's possible.
Absolutely. You
know, in my story, I talk about what I've been through, how I got through it. And it's like, look at me here, skydiving. Look at me surfing. Look at me doing this. And it's not about look at me, look at me. But look at me. If I can do it, you can do it. And that's the main point. You know, I'm just this high school dropout that joined the Army, truck driver, not such a smart guy, jumps out of airplanes kind of person. If I can do it, you can do it.
Absolutely. Well, I have some pictures I want to put up for the people that are viewing. And I want you to describe what you're feeling at that moment and just what the picture is all about.
Before you do that, I want to say, look, I see the camera's backwards on me right here. Mm-hmm. But the logo you got up here.
Yes, sir.
When I first turned the phone on, you came on. I looked at my wall because I just moved here. So I'm like, is there something on the wall?
So I should have mentioned them. That's Welcome Home Veterans. They actually sponsor my podcast, and it's a great little, it's a live museum, and there's memorabilia from each war. Guys get together and they drink coffee and they feel like they're a part of something again. And it's an amazing place. If you're ever in the Charlotte area, which you used to live in Sanford, right?
Right. Yeah. I was just in Sanford. I just left North Carolina. Yeah.
Yeah. So I live in the Wake Forest Raleigh area. So you weren't that far from me.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, Mooresville, North Carolina, it's a Welcome Home coffee shop, and it's actually saved a lot of veterans' lives. A lot of the Vietnam veteran, Korean War veterans, they talk about it. Like, if I wouldn't have found this, I probably wouldn't be here.
Well, and maybe we need to do a meet and greet there and just kind of hang out one morning and try to get people come up for some coffee. That'd be a good
dude, day. It's I amazing. Like yeah. But yeah, that's kind of funny that you thought it was on your wall. That's funny.
I'm like, look, it's good. I just moved in. Like, we've been here 2 weeks. I've been running around. Like, is there something on the wall there? I didn't notice.
Oh, that's awesome. All right. So I'm going to throw the pictures up and so people can see them and just talk a little bit about each one of them. Here we go.
That is 2003, going to Operation Iraqi Freedom, initial deployment there. And it's my youngest daughter, Mackenzie, who is now 23 years old.
Holy moly.
Her daughter, my granddaughter, Aaliyah now. So yeah, she's all grown up.
Oh, wow.
That's the picture in Colorado outside the Stanley Hotel. It's kind of the most famous picture of me. You'll probably have seen it on the internet before. It seems to go around everywhere. People use it for good and bad. Mm-hmm. But I just want to show the ladies that I still look good in the uniform.
Oh, boy.
I actually recently shot this photo for Guidepost Magazine.
Really?
They wanted a photo of me to be in the Guidepost Magazine. So that's why I recently shot that. It's at a comedy club in Austin.
Cool deal.
Yep, there's me in 2003 in Iraq, hanging out in southern Baghdad, hanging out with the locals there. They're excited of what we were doing. You know, we don't hear about that a lot. But
absolutely.
When you were there, you know it. They're excited. They're being liberated. The laws that they were stuck under before, and dictation, it's crazy.
Yeah.
There's me skydiving, having a good time. It's just the sky hooker is what I call myself, with the giant red hook there.
How cool was that?
That was awesome. I was doing it in Arizona. I got my license. I probably did 37 jumps. And then I got to jump every 60 days to keep it current. And
really?
I was traveling that much, I couldn't keep it current. But I'll still go up and do it some tandems now and then, of course. Love it.
Yeah, that's awesome, man.
Just that was on my table one day. Those are the patches I was wearing when I got injured. So you'll see on there the burnt flag that was on my right shoulder, the blood stains on the rank and everything. And I just took a picture. I thought, that looks pretty cool.
Oh, it's awesome, man. Good stuff.
What is it? Okay, it's coins and was that the reserve chute? Yep, my beret. Just some of my paraphernalia for being in and my part of my I Love Me wall.
Yeah.
And there's a picture of me at Brad Garrett's Comedy Club. I got my first debut there. 4 years to the day I was injured, all my live days, my first day performing in Vegas. And I, of course, thought that putting the flames around it was funny.
You got a great sense of humor, man. You really do. It's good stuff. Thank you.
So this is part of the Veteran Portrait Project. Stacy Pearsall was a combat veteran, Air Force. She actually got blown up the town next to me a week after me.
And really?
We didn't know that. We didn't know each other out there. But we ended up doing a documentary together, and we realized putting pieces together that we were both there same time. So she's gone around and she's taken photos like this, black and whites of veterans in every state.
Wow.
She was told she was never, ever going to be able to pick up a camera again.
Wow.
And she was able to do it. It's a Veterans Portrait Project. I think you got a couple of them in here that Stacy yep. did, and they're amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to see her in a couple of weeks. Yep, there's another one she did. I got a phone and I think I got my canteen there.
Yeah, 400
after
man.
Jump school. Yeah, after jump school, I went and bought a brand new canteen and turned that one in so I could keep my canteen.
Hey, drink water.
Yeah, that's what I thought when I got injured. When I get out, you know, in the hospital, here, drink some water. You're going back out to the, you know, you're done. You're healed.
That's awesome.
Again, that's with Stacy, a Veteran Portrait Project, holding my Purple Heart.
Cool deal, man. And the
she
last
knows how to capture people. She talks to you, gets to know you. You can bring whatever you want to one of her shoots, and she'll really capture who you are. It's pretty good.
That was awesome. Last but not least, I hate showing it, and I don't want it to. I just don't like offending anybody, and I know I hate you reliving that kind of capture, but here's the last photo.
Yeah, you can see the Humvee there. I don't know why the picture above it with my face like that, why I stitched those two together. I don't know why those are stitched together like that.
But yeah, that's his Humvee. That's the one he was in when it they ran over an IED.
Now, are you just seeing the Humvee? Are you seeing the other picture too?
I can see both.
Okay. Yeah, so I don't know if I stitched them together like that, why I did that, what post that was, something weird. We got the duh. But yeah, that's my Humvee. That's my door. You can see there, and the only part you can recognize from the Humvee, it's upside down. I guess 20 meters away from the actual hole. I've heard different stories from the guys. I didn't really get to talk to him, but like 3 years later, when I got all the photos and got the report, but I heard crawling from that door, drunk from that door, but I was actually awake, even though I don't remember anything. They said I kept complaining about my eye, that something was wrong with my eye, and I didn't know what happened.
Wow. And the last logo is Richard's Coffee Shop.
There it is. That's what's on my wall.
Yeah, there it is. But yeah, you can go to their website, check out their deal. They got an amazing museum, and it's a great little deal. But yeah, man. Now, do you have organizations that support you and like to send you different places, or you do it all on your own dime, or how's that work?
Yeah, we pretty much do it on our now. People will hire me and do that, but I also work with other nonprofits to help them. I've helped a lot of different nonprofits over the years with fundraising, with the comedy and speaking, from Chris Kyle's family to Lone Survivor Foundation, Boot Campaign. And eventually I said, all right, I need to make my own nonprofit. So 2019, I started my own nonprofit, Forging Forward. Mm-hmm. I thought I could have retreats and show other veterans and first responders how to forge forward. This is how I did it. You know, maybe I could help you. And as you know, it's outlets. Outlets help so much, whether it's out in Mother Nature, kayaking, hiking, camping. If you're like painting, for, you know, of course, for me, writing comedy, writing poetry helps me, songwriting. The shop I'm trying to get done right now, I'm going to start a forge shop for blacksmithing and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I've never done it, but yeah. I just could imagine pounding out that metal is going to be so therapeutic and building art out of it. The same thing I do with a poem, you know, I have a dark moment, I'm having a hard time, and I'll write about it and I share it with poetry. you know, try to make something beautiful out of it that I can share with others. Like, you're not alone.
Absolutely. You
know? So I'm excited about that. So what we do with Forging Forward is we'll have a retreat. Like, we have a firefighter retreat coming up next week for firefighters. And you learn the outlet. They're going to learn how to forge a knife. They're going to learn how to paint. We've done one before. We taught surfing. We taught axe throwing, forging, kayaking, deep sea fishing. Just these outlets that everybody can use to help themselves during those hard times. And you need lots of tools, right? There's not one main outlet that you can do. Like I said, I write, I paint, I want to forge. Doing the speaking helps me. That's an outlet. Sharing my story really helps me. If I can help others share their story, how to put something together to share their story. You know, it took me years to figure it out, but if I could help them speed it up and put together a program and speak and share that, you know, I want to do that. So that's what we do at Forging Forward. We have a retreat, 6 to 8 participants at a time. We want to keep it small. We all get together. We, of course, at the end of the day, after learning one of these outlets, whatever that retreat calls for, we'll say, hey, this retreat, you're going to do this or that. You can sign up. And, you know, I got free hotel, food. Sometimes, you know, depending on where the retreat is, you can drive in or we'll fly you in. And then you sit around the campfire, share some stories at the end of the day. But you get to relax, you learn a new outlet, and you make new friends, camaraderie, and keep forging forward. And then, of course, all that helps with suicide prevention. The more tools you got in your toolbox to help yourself or to help somebody else will help prevent suicide.
I agree 100%. And that's what I'm doing. I actually went and made flyers yesterday with my business card. And like I put on there, any donations help. I want to take guys camping, hunting, fishing, backpacking, whatever they want to do. You know what I mean? It's not just what I want them to do. It's a group effort. You know, if they want to go fishing, they want to go hiking, they want to go to a sporting event. That stuff is so therapeutic. You know what I mean? And, but it's not free. So, I wish I was a multimillionaire and I'd do it all on my own dime, but people that donate are amazing. And there's a lot of people out there that want to donate to organizations and stuff like this. They just don't know where to do it. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing. We team up with everybody else too. I mean, somebody else got a nonprofit, or you want to do a kayaking trip and you're like, hey, Bobby, we got, you know, 5 guys in this area that want to go kayaking. We got the kayaking donated, but we need help with food. 4G4 say, all right, we're going to take care of your food while you're doing that. You know, we'll team up and help other people out because no one can 100%. Do it all by themselves.
Absolutely. So that's amazing, man. I'll also put your website on here. And just before we end the broadcast, stay in the lobby and I'll get that from you and I'll put it in the description. Any way to get a hold of you, like website wise, obviously not your telephone. I don't want your telephone blowing up a million times, but no, what you do is amazing, man. You got an amazing story, and I can't thank you enough for coming on, man. You are light at the end of a tunnel for a lot of people. You know what I mean?
No, thank you, brother. I appreciate it. You know, one of the things I always tell everybody is you do what you can with what you have where you're at. Roosevelt said it. It's an amazing saying. I love sharing that, and that's what you're doing. You know, you're doing what you can with what you have where you're at. And you're able to do this. And we've talked about it earlier. It's just, you know, every one person we can help. If there's one person that hears this, it's worth it.
I agree, man. I agree. I didn't know how I was going to give back, but I love this. And it helps me, you know. It really does.
Yep.
So, but man, I appreciate you coming on. Hang out in the little lobby for a second like we did before you came on. And I'll get all this information from you, and then I'll post it on here.
All right. Sounds good, brother.
Again, thank you again, brother, for coming on. Your story is amazing. I hope everybody likes it and goes to his website to get in touch with him, book him, and enjoy the podcast.